This is Culturetopia, your weekly dose of arts and culture from National Public Radio. I'm Netta Ulaby, reporter for NPR's Arts Desk.
And I'm Bob Mondello, movie critic for All Things Considered.
And I'm Sarah Saracen, and I am Bob and Netta's editor. Welcome, Sarah.
Thank you.
It's really good to have you here.
Just a reminder, you can subscribe to this podcast at npr.org/Culturetopia this week.
Juno director Jason Reitman takes to the skies with his new film Up in the Air.
The groundbreaking rock band Living Color looks back on writing their biggest hit song.
And author Neil Gaiman, who's into pondering all kinds of wonderful things about the future, ponders the future of audiobooks. But first,
music in the digital decade. Way back when, the move from 78s to vinyl records let people listen longer, and the cassette tape made music portable. But over the past decade, the MP3 has yanked music free from physical formats. NPR's Jacob Gans has been talking with people about the evolution in music listening.
Let's start out with one unassailable fact about the way people listen to music in 2009.
Technology has spoken, the people have spoken, there's kind of no putting the genie back in the bottle.
That's Justin Ouellette, the creator of the music website Muxtape. Suddenly, everything about the way we listen to music is different. Well, maybe not so suddenly. In this era of immediate gratification, it's easy to forget the history behind the effortless download, so here goes. In the middle of the 1990s, programmers came up with a method of shrinking the size of digital audio files. They called it MPEG-1 Audio Layer 3. At the very end of that decade, college student Sean Fanning started a web-based program called Napster that enabled users to share MP3 files. Feverish bootlegging followed. The recording industry battled back with lawsuits. Apple dominated the market for MP3 players with its iPod, released in late 2001. Online retailers began offering legal downloading alternatives. Apple dominated this market with iTunes. MP3 blogs, aggregators, and BitTorrent programs offered new ways to own music without actually paying for it. Record sales collapsed. But here's the thing. It's possible that music lovers today have more access and listen to more music than ever before.
There's just a staggering amount of music to listen to. There are days when I really don't know what to do.
That's Sasha Frere-Jones, the pop music critic for The New Yorker.
MP3s are kind of the best and the worst thing in the world. We've never been able to trade music so quickly. I will talk to somebody on IM and they will give me a song while we're talking. But I don't really like how MP3s sound.
We used to hear big sound coming out of big speakers. Our friends would come over and listen to a brand new album we just took out of the shrink wrap. Now we download songs from MP3 blogs, post a link on Sendspace and send a note to friends, or stream the song from our Tumblr.
Because of MP3s, everyone can get their hands on it right away. I always think of that as a conversation. That's the word I have in my head.
Instead of the conversation happening between a few friends, you can now listen to music with anyone, anywhere, any way you want.
I was talking to the head of a label. He's from the vinyl generation, and he said, now I even feel like it's a big deal to turn to the CD player and put a CD in. You're so used to clicking on links and having it be right there.
The New Yorker's Sasha Frere-Jones says telling people how they're supposed to listen to music is a losing game.
To tell a kid, oh, that iPod, you know, forget that. I want you to go out and buy a turntable and an amplifier and two speakers, and then you got to take the record out of the sleeve. You know, they'll be asleep before you finish your sentence.
Jacob did a completely different piece, a second piece, about the ways music making has changed, which you can hear on our website, as well as our end-of-the-decade music coverage, all at npr.org/music.
One thing that I thought was really interesting about all of this digital music stuff is the Beatles are one of these last big holdouts. They will not sell digital downloads, right? And when they released a couple of months ago the remastered catalog, and Bob Boylan from NPR Music, he said this incredible sentence about this remastered catalog that he loved. He said, they're the last CDs you'll ever buy.
Ooh. And I did, actually. The sound was so different on them. It just felt different. And I realized that I've been listening to music that hasn't been complete in the same way that I used to go to a concert hall and hear a band or an orchestra or something like that. And it didn't, all of a sudden, it did feel different from what I'd been listening to recently. And back in the old days, and I'm old enough to remember them, I'm afraid, vinyl actually did sound a lot like the real experience. You know, you'd go to a concert hall and you'd get back to the same thing. It was very weird.
We're going to talk about corporate malfeasance now. I don't quite know how to make a segue there, but there's this TV show, Better Off Ted, that I watched last season. It's going to start up again on ABC. And it's about this guy, Ted, who runs the R&D department in a conglomerate, Viridian Dynamics. It's sort of a parody of massive corporations, and it makes all kinds of crazy things, like weaponized pumpkins. Series creator Victor Fresco and co-star Portia de Rossi recently spoke to host Guy Raz about how they came up with this idea for this series.
There's a few things I have been interested in over the years. And one is, and I think this is from being a new parent, the sort of disconnect between our personal and public lives that we can most of us teach our kids to be moral, to know right and wrong. And yet when we go into the workplace and we work for giant corporations, we see decisions made that are not based on any of those qualities that we want our kids to have.
And Ted, we should point out the main character is a single father and his daughter is sort of like his moral compass.
Right. In the pilot episode, which aired last season, Ted is tasked by Veronica. They want to cryonically freeze one of their employees. Right. They think that's ready for testing.
And they think this is normal. The company thinks it's perfectly normal to freeze one of their employees for a year.
Yes. It's only when his daughter, he goes home and talks to his daughter, who points out that this is insane, that he realizes that maybe this isn't the correct path that he's on.
Lem mentioned that there's something weird going on with the motion sensors in the lab.
Oh, yeah. It works by detecting light reflected off the skin. Although there is a problem. It doesn't seem to see black people. Weird, huh?
That's more than weird, Veronica. That's basically, well, racist.
The company's position is that it's actually the opposite of racist, because it's not targeting black people, it's just ignoring them. They insist the worst people can call it is indifferent.
And there's always sort of a glitch in what Viridian's research department comes up with. It's your character's job, Veronica's job, to kind of spin the whole thing to the company's advantage.
I think she just doesn't really feel like ethics play a part in the workplace. She just sees it as the company succeeding or the company failing, and she'll do everything in her power to make sure both she and the company succeed.
Well, they know it has to be fixed, right?
Of course they do, and they're working on it. In the meantime, they'd like to remind everyone to celebrate the fact that it does see Hispanics, Asians, Pacific Islanders, and Jews.
She just really wants to do the company's bidding. That's easy to parody, because when that runs amok, people start doing all kinds of crazy things in order to spin and to put, you know, a positive look at what they're doing.
Victor Fresco, I'm curious about a feature that you have on the show. Many times before a commercial break, there's a fake commercial for Viridian Dynamics, and I want to play one of them.
Viridian Dynamics. We're the future of food. Tomatoes. The size of this baby. Lemon-flavored fish. Organic vegetables, chock full of antidepressants.
I have to say, when I first saw this commercial break, it threw me a bit. It took me a second to realize that it was actually fake.
There's things in there, as I listened to it, of vegetables chock full of antidepressants. Well, that obviously isn't happening yet, I'm hoping. So that there are tip-offs that tell us it's fake. But I think it's actually becoming more difficult to parody corporate culture. Anything you can imagine that happens at these high levels has probably happened.
They had this really great thing on Weekend All Things Considered when this interview aired, is they had them record a special funder.
This part of All Things Considered has been brought to you by Viridian Dynamics, fighting for the rights of giant companies like us over people like you. Viridian Dynamics. We're big. You're small. We win.
Sarah, you had challenged us before we started recording this podcast to think about our favorite fictional corporations. And I started thinking about it because I always do as I'm told. And what I realized is that you can break all of them down into one of four categories.
Okay.
And the following categories are Mega, Mono, Michael, and Meta.
Okay.
Okay. So Mega is a monstrous consumer corporation that has a hand in everything you do. Mm-hmm. It makes pharmaceuticals. It makes medical hardware. It makes killer robots. It makes computers. It makes cosmetics. And those would be the corporations like Omni Consumer Products and RoboCop, or the Umbrella Corporation and Resident Evil, mm-hmm. or slightly more benignly, the by and large of WALL-E, the manufactured WALL-E.
Oh, right.
Yeah. I think the Viridian Dynamics is probably right there with that.
It is a mega. Mm-hmm. A Mono is a single-purpose corporation, something like the Soylent Food Company, for example, mm-hmm. or the or Cyberdyne in the Terminator. These are companies that make one thing, and they tend to do it very, very well and very, very evilly, unless they are Spacely's sprockets, like in the Jetsons. Now, the Michael category is something else. Every single book or movie that Michael Crichton has had a hand in has an evil corporation, which is so funny because he was kind of a politically conservative guy, right? You'd think he would be very pro-corporation, but no, International Genetic Technologies.
Jurassic Park, very, very bad. High point was when the dinosaur would eat a lawyer, or when the Nakamoto Corporation in Rising Sun, Digicom in Disclosure. These are all, he had bad nanorobotics companies, bad aircraft companies. He was all about the bad companies. Finally, we've got the meta category. And that would be something like anything that J.J. Abrams touches. He's got all of these funny little corporations that go through Cloverfield, and then they're an Alias, and they're these Japanese deep-sea drilling companies that make crazy soft drinks that his characters might drink in yet another movie. But the ultimate fictional corporation, are you ready for it?
Yeah.
Acme.
Acme.
Of course.
Absolutely. Acme. I was going to say that I have one that I'm really liking right now that is a J.J. Abrams one. He's got this show Fringe, and all kinds of crazy, creepy things happen, and always ties back to this company called Massive Dynamic.
Nice.
Massive Dynamic, which is both, I think that's two. I think it's the Meta and the Omni. Right.
I actually like films where the corporation's real. I mean, if you think Aaron Brockovich and Pacific Gas and Electric, really, I mean, they're just evil in that. You know, they're poisoning people, they're denying coverage, they're doing all kinds of things. And there's a whole series of those movies lately that have had major corporations that are, you know, making a smoke and all
right.
kind of, yeah, it's kind of grim. Actually, this is another segue. There's a corporation, and it's a fictional one, in the new Jason Reitman picture that is all about firing people, which is talk about hitting the zeitgeist just right. Jason Reitman is kind of amazing. He just turned 32 in October, and his resume looks pretty impressive. He has made Thank You for Smoking, which is also about a corporation that's trying to, make you smoke. Juno, which has nothing to do with corporations, but which got him nominated for an Oscar, and now Up in the Air, in which George Clooney makes a lifestyle out of frequent flying while he is trying to help companies fire people. He thinks he's humane because he does that with motivational speeches, preaching freedom from social and family ties.
Make no mistake, your relationships are the heaviest components in your life. All those negotiations and arguments and secrets, compromises. The slower we move, the faster we die. Make no mistake, moving is living. Some animals were meant to carry each other, to live symbiotically over a lifetime. Star-crossed lovers, monogamous swans. We are not swans. We're sharks.
Robert Siegel spoke with Reitman about the differences between his movie and the Walter Kern novel the film was based on.
Well, there's key elements that I've added. Now, Walter's book is about Ryan Bingham, a man who fires people for a living, who lives his entire life on the road, airplane to airplane, hotel to hotel, collecting air miles religiously and living alone. That's kind of his primary philosophy, that he wants to live without anyone or anything. And that's something that I really locked into. Now, from there, I injected a lot of my own plot, including two women, a character named Alex, played by Vera Farmiga, and a character named Natalie, played by Anna Kendrick, who really become the challenge to Ryan's philosophy.
And a family wedding enjoys a role in the film, which is kind of off-screen in the novel. It's not nearly so significant. And the kind of Goldman Sachs McKinsey of management consulting, which is the sort of off-screen Moby Dick of the novel's life, is totally missing. This is a significant variation on the novel.
Well, I think it's better when you say it than I do. I think if I said it, it would come off a little arrogant. But coming from you, it really makes me look better. So I appreciate that.
Now, the character George Clooney plays, Ryan Bingham, fires people for a living. He's a consultant who's retained to do what Walter Kern refers to, at least as a career transition consulting, in explaining to people what happens now that you don't have a job. And you have people who play the part of people who've lost their jobs. Some of them are actors, but not all of them are actors.
Yeah, I mean, this is what comes with writing a movie over such a long period of time. When I started writing this screenplay, we were in the midst of an economic boom, and by the time I was finished, we were in one of the worst recessions on record. And as I approached the shooting of this film, there was no way I could use the original scenes that I had written, which approached firing in a very satirical manner. I mean, similar to Thank You for Smoking. We were location scouting in St. Louis and Detroit, two cities that really got hit hard. And it just became clear to me that we should use real people, people who had actually lost their jobs, So we put an ad out in both local papers saying we were making a documentary about job loss. And they would go through a 10-minute process where we would interview them, and then we would actually tell them, we'd like to now fire you on camera. And when they would hear those words, you'd see them change. One girl just literally just broke into hives across her neck as she's in the film. So there was something about being in that moment amongst people who you could tell had not really talked about this to anybody. They said the kinds of things that I would never have thought to write as a writer.
It's one of the worst moments in a person's life to be fired, to lose your job in tough economic times and wonder what you're going to do next and how you're going to provide for your family.
You know, if you had asked me before I did this movie what is the worst part about losing a job in this type of economy, I would have probably said the loss of income. But as I talked to these people, that actually rarely came up. What people said time and time again was, I don't know what I'm supposed to do. And this was kind of a startling statement, that it was really about a lack of purpose. They would say, you know, after I finish this interview, I'm going to go get in my car and I have nowhere to be. Mm-hmm. And I can't imagine thinking that every day.
There's a character who accompanies George Clooney's character in the movie who attacks the project of firing people with a great deal of enthusiasm and intellectual zeal. And she is played by a young actress named Anna Kendrick. And you've probably had these moments in movies. I think we all have. And I definitely had it watching Kate Winslet in Heavenly Creatures or Brad Pitt and Thelma and Louise, where you think, oh, that person is going to be a major movie star. Yeah. Anna Kendrick is going to be a major movie star. She walks across the room. She doesn't have to open her mouth. You know exactly who she is. She's amazing. She's a reason to see this movie.
So is Vera Farmiga, who is breathtaking. I mean, she's really amazing. And she keeps on getting cast in the same kind of part where she's really sexy, sort of effortlessly and appealing. But, I mean, you know you'd never get through somehow. And she manages to have the allure because she's kind of unreachable in a way. And she keeps on doing that, I guess, just because she's really good at it. But it's like I have all these other things I want to see her do.
Well, she's kind of the female George Clooney in that way. They're very
well
matched.
Oh, interesting. That's nice. Yeah.
Netta, you know that one of my favorite things to say always is we've been listening to stories through our ears since before we were people. And one of our great storytellers, Neil Gaiman, had a really nice piece on Morning Edition about the audiobook, which is people sharing stories through their ears. And he talks to writer David Sedaris about what makes a great audiobook and a great reader.
Author David Sedaris records his own audiobooks, which will come as no surprise to anyone who has heard his NPR pieces. When I decided to investigate the world of audiobooks, I started with David.
I'm a huge tapeworm. I think I heard my first one. It was one of those musty ones. You would find them at the library in boxes the size of a suitcase. They were actual tapes. And that's where I first started with audiobooks. I often believe that nobody could appreciate the iPod more than me. I think that it was invented especially for me. I would fight for my iPod. Like, I wouldn't fight for my freedom, but I would fight for my iPod.
But audiobooks can vary wildly. The person reading makes all the difference.
Like, I hate it when a guy is reading a book and he'll say, there was a knock on the door. It was Rebecca. Well, it's about time, she said. Like, that doesn't sound like a woman. It sounds like a drag queen.
Rick Harris is a longtime audio director.
There are actors who are just known for their loud stomach noises. Very talented Jerry Orbach came in to do something for me, and he had been up playing cards the night before. And I'd say his stomach noises were about as loud as his voice. But we've put, you know, blankets on people's stomach. You shift mic position. You cope.
And you do cope. Of course, there are those who don't like audiobooks. Critic Harold Bloom said that deep reading really demands the inner ear as well as the outer ear. You need the whole cognitive process, that part of you which is open to wisdom. You need the text in front of you. I find that astonishingly unconvincing. I think you can have a close and perfectly valid relationship with the text when you hear it. But I've met a lot of people who, when asked if they've read a book, hesitate and say, well, I've listened to it. So is an audiobook a book? Audio producer Rick Harris again.
It is not a book. An audiobook is a separate entity. A novel can be seen as many things, and one of the things it can be seen as is a script for an audio performance. But it is another thing. It is an audio book that has its own validity, its own limitations, its own strengths. The human voice is unquestionably the most expressive musical instrument there is. Combine those two and you get an audiobook.
An audiobook is its own thing, a unique medium that goes in through the ear and sometimes leaves you sitting in the driveway to find out how the story is going to end.
That's guitarist Vernon Reed, founder of the band Living Color, from the 1988 song Cult of Personality. Now, Cult of Personality is on nearly every list of the 100 greatest rock songs ever. It won the band critical acclaim, Grammys, stadium rock fame. But what made Living Color really unique was something else. In the white-dominated world of hard rock, all of the band members were black. We have Guy Raz again speaking with Vernon Reed and Corey Glover of Living Color about how they feel about their biggest hit today.
I remember the day that song was written. It was literally written in one rehearsal session. And there was no Cult of Personality at the beginning, and at the end there was. And we played it, I think, a day or so later at CBGB's for the first time. So the song has had this amazing life, and nobody was prepared for it on a level. But many artists have a rueful kind of feeling towards their most popular song, and they kind of despise it. Mm. I actually still love the song Cult of Personality, because it's really so much more relevant now than it was then.
Corey Glover, Living Color became really huge, really fast at the end of the 1980s. The Grammy Awards and touring with the Rolling Stones, a cover of Rolling Stone magazine. These days you're playing to smaller crowds and you're selling fewer records. Is that in any way harder to deal with?
I'm always reminded of an incident in Raleigh, North Carolina, where we were on the Stones tour and I decided to go to a mall. For whatever reason, I didn't have a hat on, so my hair was long and it was down my back, and I got mobbed for some strange reason.
Everybody recognized it because you had the...
Lots.
It wasn't just girls. It was a lot of folks. It was people. It was just a crush of people. Now, I was really taken aback, and it really sort of traumatized me. Like, what I'm doing right now and how it's going right now is so much better for me, because there is no pressure. There is no sort of like fishbowl experience in that.
That's it for this week.
And you can find links to all the stories we have today and subscribe to this podcast at npr.org/culturetopia. I'm Bob Mondello.
I'm Sarah Sarason.
And I'm Neda Ulibi. Thanks for listening to Culturetopia. Culturetopia.